a better way. You don't have to think.
Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirico with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday, beginning with the oldest of them and going forward. There's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years, so sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And please join me on this episode of Friday Flashbacks, episode 22, as we flash back originally to December the 14th, 2010, episode 570. It was Sam Kaufman from thehumanpath.com. In this episode, we were joined by Sam, a former Special Forces soldier and wilderness survival trainer, to discuss survival training, permaculture, rebuilding after collapse, and more. And I will say that Sam is one of the people that I interviewed that I also got to meet in the real world, press palms with, talk to, and actually work with him on some of his training. He was the real deal and a really good dude. I hope you enjoy this flashback. Oh, going back just a little while, about 14 years. All right, with that, let's go ahead and, as I said, we have Sam Kaufman here today from The Human Path. Sam, thanks for joining us on the Survival Podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
Sam, can you start out, just because, I mean, most folks here didn't get to come down there and meet you and maybe don't know you. Who are you? How'd you get into this wilderness and primitive skills thing? How'd you end up being what you are today?
Yeah, it's a good question, Jack. Thanks for asking it. It's something that's probably has been part of my life for the last 25 years or so, in terms of trying to teach and trying to kind of organize the information, the wealth of information. As you know, as probably all your listeners know, there's just a humongous amount of information out there when you start getting interested in primitive living skills or wilderness skills. You know, everything from food to water to shelter to fire to security. You know, I mean, how do you break all that down? And so, as you know, I was in the Special Forces for about 6 years. I was in the Army for about 10 years, and four of those years were as a linguist, actually as an interrogator, but also as a linguist, a German linguist, and then the other six were as a Special Forces medic. And having been growing up kind of in the woods a lot as a child with my parents and our family, and having an interest anyway in that, and then of course getting into it through the military, you know, as a medic, I started realizing, you know, when we were out in the woods a lot, you know, what would we do if we couldn't drop in our medical supplies? What would we do if we couldn't hike them in on our backs? You know, what do we do then? And that was when I first started kind of getting interested in plant medicine and pharmacognosy and, you know, where our medicines really come from, where they really do come from, as we all know, you know, and the reason that pharmaceutical companies spend billions each year trying to uncover and find new medicines, because they come from the plant world. And so that interested me a lot in herbology and the study of plant medicine. And then, you know, from there, just kind of, you know, I taught a lot for the Special Forces as well. I taught a lot of, you know, wilderness survival type stuff, and a lot of other stuff too. But, you know, it kind of pertains to a small unit tactics and such as well. But anyway, over the period of you know, probably about 15 or 20 years, I kind of spent a lot of time trying to organize this information in my own head. And so, you know, how do you go about breaking down information into small, digestible, you know, structures that people can learn and learn quickly and remember quickly. And so that's kind of what this is all about.
Very cool. And one of the things I really dig about what you're doing, your company's called, your school's called The Human Path. And I talk a lot on the show about, you know, being what you really are, a human being. What was the kind of the impetus, the inspiration to use that as kind of your brand and the name of what you're doing?
Yeah, that's a huge can of worms, and it's something that, you could probably talk for hours about, but, what does it really mean to be a human being? I mean, what are we as a species? First of all, really, where that all came from was the fact that if we look around us, and part of what your show is probably about, too, and certainly your listeners are in tune with, is the fact that we really are on, we are on the edge of kind of a possible, precipice of either disaster in terms of eco-disaster or financial disaster or any number of things that could send us kind of over the edge as a species or certainly as a society or as a group of societies around the planet. Whether or not that happens, remains to be seen, but irrespective of whether or not, disaster ever strikes either in small or large quantities, still begs the question as to what are we really, how did we get in this situation in the first place? And so, I have the motto for my school, trying to be the best, learning to be the best possible human in the worst possible circumstances. And that's a large part of it. A lot of people who study survival or are into preparedness, there's the old maxim of beans, bullets, and Band-Aids and that kind of mentality for the short term. But really, if you wanted to be a survivor long term, what does that mean? I mean, is that really being a human? Is that really surviving to hole up in your bunker for the next 2 years and shoot people who you think might be trying to take your MREs away from you? I mean, that's not really the way I want to live as a human being. Honestly, I'd rather check out than spend a life, living that way. And so I think it's important to teach people to how to rebuild, how to change kind of how we live. And as they do that, whether it's because we're going to have a disaster or not, but as you start to teach people that and the whole classes where you're learning that kind of a mentality about really using our resources wisely and connecting to them, then it changes how you live right now. And if it can change how you live right now, then, maybe it'll have an effect, hopefully, on who we are as a species and maybe our long-term survival chances. And that's something that I think that there's really very little conversation or thought about is what are we as a species? I mean, you've probably heard the old analogy of if you could take the entire history of the planet, I mean, literally from the moment that the planet was born and such up till now, and you could shrink that into 1 year, and in that case, I think somewhere around November, you start in the November of the year. If it started in January, and about November, you'd have, life in the seas and in oceans. And about December the 15th or December 1st to 15th, about those 2 weeks, dinosaurs would have ruled the earth. And about 3 days before, midnight of New Year's Eve is when humans started to walk the planet. And the Industrial Revolution would be about 3 seconds before midnight. So, I mean, if you think about that from that perspective, it's taken us 3 seconds to use up the resources that were gathered over the previous, that were created over that period of a year, one way or another. It doesn't matter what you believe as to where that creation comes from, but just the fact that we, as a species, have just eaten our way through massive amounts of resources without any care and leaving huge amounts of waste and toxicity for our grandchildren behind. All of those things kind of go into when I say, what does it really mean to be a human being? I mean, the first question you really have to ask yourself is, do we want to survive as a species or not?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what, anybody that was wondering why did I bring Sam on the show just got your answer. I mean, there's so much commonality there with the philosophy of the show and what we talk about every day. So you're among kindred spirits here, definitely. I also think that to me, anyway, when I look at what you're doing and you talk about the human path, I look around and go, a lot of these problems and this misery that we have is because so many people are so far off of walking a true human path. It's not a human thing to use up everything that you need for yourself and for your children so that no one else has it. It's not a human thing to put ourselves into this position. And people don't recognize it because it's what everybody else is doing. They just kind of fall in line. But as soon as you break the cycle, and like when you go out and teach somebody how to make a fire from a primitive skill, it's not just learning the skill and the empowerment of learning the skill, but all of a sudden the concept of warmth, you have an entirely new appreciation for being warm. Like, oh, right. This is what it really – so now that I'm burning that thimble of fossil fuel – to keep myself warm, not whether it's evil or bad or anything to burn it, at least I have an appreciation from how much energy that really represents. And I think most of us have no idea. And that's, like you say, it's not being a human to do that.
Right. And I call it kind of the false baseline. And what I mean by that is that we have this, you know, to be a little more blunt about it, what I call a mutually agreed upon hallucination that we call, you know, social reality around us. And it's what I call just a false baseline. I mean, that's the baseline that we're always at. So you get out of norm with that baseline one way or another, whether you're cold or you're hungry or whether you're, had a lot of stress at work, or maybe you're not getting enough money and you wanted to buy extra presents for Christmas or whatever. And then you pull back into that baseline somewhere and you feel that comfort. And that baseline is so far off from really what we are as human beings. That baseline means that you've got a big screen TV and that you've got, you know, food that you warmed up in the microwave. And as far as you know, that food grew up in, you know, inside of a styrofoam box somewhere. And you've got literally at your fingertips, out of everything that you touch during the day. This is a good exercise, and this is what I mean by baseline, is that if you were to go through and you wrote down on a piece of paper everything that you interacted with or touched for the day, and then you took that list, you know, and let's say that's 1,000 things, it probably would be somewhere in that number, and then out of that 1,000 things, you tried to figure out where those came from or how those were made, or if somebody said, okay, guess what, tomorrow you got to make all those 1,000 things. What's the percentage you think human beings could make? You know, I'm going to guess probably less than 5%. Maybe that's even way high. But, you know, the fossil fuels we use for plastic, all the things that go into that are this false baseline that don't have anything connected to what we really are. And if you take that one more step, you could say, okay, let's say the disaster hit today and whatever, a plague, and it wiped out 95% or 90% of humanity, and 10% of our population was spread over the globe. Now, granted, you know, there are some people that short-term would probably survive and the people that do that, but I'm not talking necessarily about those people. I'm talking about those people's grandchildren. Now, in 30 or 40 years from now, or 50 years from now, you know, how much of that gunpowder is still going to work? How much gasoline is still going to work? You know, nobody has any idea how to refine gasoline or to make a car or to make plastics. And all of those things are completely separate as a baseline from where you are when you, like you said, rub two sticks together to make fire that suddenly connects you to the actual element of heat and what that's really all about, not what we turned it into with this false baseline.
Man, I'm completely in sync with you there. Your training up until what you're kind of moving to some new things in 2011, I want to talk about in a bit, but kind of just in line with everything we've been talking about, you've really focused on primitive skills, wilderness skills. When I met you the first time down at Marjorie's, you were teaching us how to make figure four deadfall traps and some other traps so that if you ended up in a situation where you had to feed yourself, whether it was a cotton rat or a squirrel, you could get some protein into your body. And you focused on a lot of things like that. Why did you start in that place? Is it keeping in line with the stuff we've been talking about? Is there more to it?
Yeah, that's really who I am. I mean, that's really what the human path is to me. And let me just quickly explain kind of the concept. The concept is that we have what I call the core concepts, or, you know, a core structure. And around that, we have a number of different kind of specialties. And this kind of goes back. What I've done is I've kind of merged the worlds of, say, Special Forces team, you know, the concept of a team in Special Forces, which was an engineer and a commo guy and a medic and a weapons guy and a team lead. And I've merged that kind of with maybe what you could say was Native American scout, like Apache scout type, viewpoint or, you know, kind of that connection. And so, the idea was to have a core concept of which for me was the primitive living skills, as you said, and then around that kind of have peripheral classes that supported that as well. So what I do is I have a core, what I call the core basic, and now it's called the primitive core basic because we're going into urban stuff too. So there's just a primitive core basic, and that covered five different areas basically, which was primitive engineering. And the second area was what I call the combat medic, which is both combat and medicine, really two heads of the same coin. In other words, how to help and how to hurt the body. The third one is what I call the hunter-gatherer, which is basically the connection to their environment, to our earth. And the fourth one is what I call the scout or spy, which is basically connection, you know, kind of the eyes and ears of the team. And the fifth was leadership. So there's this core basic idea, and a person had to go through that and or has to go through that. And my experience and my love is certainly the wilderness and the woods, and so that's what I'm all about. And so I have peripheral classes like herbology, which anyone can take. You know, anybody can take herbology level 1, 2, 3, and so on. Anybody can take, and I have a tracking classes. Anybody can take tracking 1, 2, 3. Anybody can take my fitness classes, a combat fitness versus scout fitness, which includes things like kind of like parkour or you know, moving through, but in the woods, you know, learning how to move fluidly and quietly through the woods and quickly over obstacles and that type of thing. So all of, you know, all of those things are all kind of peripheral classes that help a person who's into the core concepts get better at any of those areas. Well, then I met a guy by the name of Paul Range, who and his partner Gloria Haswell, who live on about 50 acres south of San Antonio, that is a completely off the grid environment that they've lived on and they've worked with for, gosh, I think like 20 years. And Paul himself also has, you know, we're kind of similar in that respect because he's also ex-Special Forces. Of course, he's about a generation older than me, and he was in Vietnam for several tours and such. So, you know, really a very, very knowledgeable person with a huge amount of experience behind him. And he they do things that are more on the line of urban type of preparedness, you know. So, and then, of course, the homesteading and green homesteading, living off the grid, you know, windmill. He's got his own windmill designs. He's got like three or four different that are specifically his. One that doesn't even require welding. So that's kind of his aspect, and just seemed like such a natural fit to go ahead and take the primitive core basic and make a parallel track that's sort of the mirror image of it, but from an urban standpoint. And it's a little less, you know, primitive core basic's a little bit harder on the body. It's, you know, you gotta like being cold and hungry and wet outside and all that stuff. And it's maybe for a younger person. The urban core basic's a little more, you know, it's more dealing with different aspects of preparedness in your own backyard, in your own home, in a FEMA shelter if it had to be, all those different things, and then moving out from there. And then he has a set of peripheral classes as well that are like the green homesteading and eventually things like, you know, how do you build a forge? You know, how do you build a box bellows? How do you make charcoal? How do you, all those things that kind of go along with homesteading.
Awesome. And you do put a lot of emphasis, when I looked at all your courses and all, you do a lot with herbology. I get the vibe that that's a big thing for you. And I think that there's two ways to look at when because we really look at it at its core. Herbology is the identification and knowledge of plant life.
Right.
You and a lot of wilderness trainers are going to teach you maybe the very basics of some medicinal things that grow this on poison ivy. But mostly what wilderness trainers do from an herbal standpoint is this is what you eat. This is how you stay alive, right? You brought the healing component into it. That seems like it's a big deal for you. Is that part of your medic roots with Special Forces, or is it just who you are, or is it just because it's damn well important? We're all three.
Yeah, right. And it's a little of everything too in that regard. But definitely, I'm always been interested in medicine. Very interested in medicine. I mean, I had kind of a midlife crisis when my son was getting ready to graduate high school. I thought, you know, I wanted to go to med school back when I first got out as a Special Forces medic, but I couldn't. My kids were young. I couldn't drag them into that. There was just no way I can do it this time. So I kept my full time job, but I was working across the street from a university so I could go to night school. I got all my, went back to school. You know, I already had a degree, of course, but went back to school and got all that stuff, did my MCAT, got into a bunch of different med schools, which is part of why I'm in San Antonio, because I got accepted down here. But, you know, 6 months into it, it was just so apparent that it was going to destroy my family. I mean, my daughter is still, you know, she's a young teenager. She rides horses very well competitively. It takes money. My son still needs money for school. You know, all those things come in, and it's just like, there's no way I can just put my life financially on hold. Anyway, that's kind of a sidetrack. But my point is that I've always really, really loved medicine. I've thought it's just something that fascinates me, specifically trauma medicine. But so that's part of it. But the second part is really that, you know, really not so much that herbs are, or plants, I'm sorry, are not, that it's not important to do food as well, because we certainly do that. I certainly teach plenty of that. But really, you know, even if you've eaten, you know, if you've ever lived on wild foods, you know, like out, and for me, that's mostly in the Colorado area, since that's where I'm originally from. The first time I started doing that, I noticed, you know, there was just an intense difference between the effect of eating some wild food versus what I, you know, what I was used to eating. And that effect was just because those wild foods are so rich in nutrients, and not necessarily in calories now, but in nutrients. And so I started realizing, you know, really, and this is what I teach in herbology, is really, you know, herbs just kind of span the spectrum from being what I kind of call power foods, where you get things like, you know, nettles and asparagus and such, all the way up to things that are toxic, and yet they're very medicinal in small doses, or, you know, what we would call poison. So, you know, as you start to get into plants and work with plants a lot, you start to realize there's no plant that probably doesn't have some kind of a usage and relationship to the human body, especially in your own, you know, biome, in your own biosphere, in your own kind of microclimate, wherever you find yourself living. If you've lived there for long enough, you know, I really think that you find that there are uses for every plant out there, you know, in some way or another, and there's some effect. So whether that is food or whether that's medicine, it's really, in a sense, you know, food is medicine. It's
correct.
Obviously keeps you alive. So
I'd like to get your, just kind of a little aside here, but just from your background, I'd like to get your take on this, because you deep in herbology, some medical training at a military level, some medical schooling. I heard, I think it's Andrew Weil, who's one of my real idols in the alternative medicine sphere, say one time, the important thing that people understand is every single drug, whether it comes from a plant or from a pharmacy, is a toxin. And if you take enough of it, it will damage you or kill you. And we use that toxin in moderation to treat the body for specific reasons, which is, you know, people generally think of medicine as something that's naturally good for you, rather than it has a toxic effect. And what you're trying to do is treat the malady with the toxic effect at a level that the body can handle.
Right. And that's exactly right. I mean, honestly, what medicine is all about to me is creating an environment in your body for it to be able to heal itself. I mean, that's really all it is.
Absolutely.
We're all walking around. Like right now, you and I probably have plenty of group A streptococcus bacteria in our throats, you know, so why don't we have strep throat, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, until you created the environment where your own immune system, for one reason or another, you're tired, you're hungry, you're sick, your immune system compromised, allows that disease to happen. And so herbs are the way to be able to rebalance that. And there's a lot of different ways to see that. You know, we in the West, we kind of, in Western, I mean, by allopathic medicine, we tend to really see it as a cause and effect linear relationship. And I, the more that I study it and the more that I learn it, I realize it really isn't that at all. But there's nothing wrong with that. And it's sort of like, you know, if you were standing on a line that drew a huge circle, like the circumference of the earth or smaller even, but just to where it looked like a straight line to the horizon, you know, you're telling yourself this is a straight line when it's really part of a circle. And I mean, really, I think as you get more perspective on plants as medicine, you realize that there is so much we don't understand about how our bodies work and function energetically and whatever. I mean, that's a word that I'm just throwing out there that probably doesn't even describe it, but there's something way beyond what actually happens physically. I mean, nobody, not even the most experienced doctor in the world, you know, you find me one that can explain to us how our bodies really heal themselves. I mean, really, how do they do it? I'm not talking about that you can tell me the mechanics of blood clotting, you know, mechanism,
mm-hmm.
anything like that. I'm just saying, how is it that you cut your body, and really, unless you have some kind of a congenital disorder, you know, that your body is going to repair itself whether you try to stop it from that or not. And, you know, how does that happen? How is it that there is some sort of a, you know, there's something there that you cannot measure, and even if you could, you know, our measuring tools really, you know, on a philosophical level are nothing more than calibration devices for something we've already discovered through use of those measuring tools. I mean, we just kind of work in these little small steps of discovering something new that we supposedly measured, you know, so that we can create more measuring tools to measure that. And
yeah, I'm completely in sync with you there. I don't remember where I heard this, but it was some level of a debate between a naturopathic practitioner and an allopathic practitioner. And what the natural person said was, you can say whatever you want about, you're talking about like the ability of an arm, a cut to heal. And exactly what this person said was to the effect of, if I take and I cut my arm, there's things that we can do with medicine, whether from my world or your world, that will speed or impede that healing. But it will heal. if we take a dead person and slice their arm, you can give it every antibiotic, you can stitch it, you can do anything you want, but when the life force is gone, that wound will absolutely never heal, and there's nothing science can do to change that. And that force is what you're talking about has to be placed in balance.
Right.
Awesome.
Exactly.
Awesome. So let's kind of talk about this urban thing, because I was like really excited to see you guys bringing that out. You've got this new thing called, and you've been doing parts of it, but it seems like you really took it to another level coming in early 2011, Urban Core. And it goes into a lot of great stuff. Can you tell us about the Urban Core and what's the long-range goal for that?
Yeah, so the Urban Core Basic is a new development. We're going to start that in January, and it's a three-weekend series. Basically, it's mirrored to the Primitive Core Basic. So each one of the what I call the Core Basic is basically, like it says, it's sort of the basic. So you can think of it as basic training as such over a series of different pieces of information and practice and skills. Each one, the Primitive and the Urban both, are approximately 48 class hours in length. The Primitive, I do it in three-day weekends, so it's like people usually get there on Thursday night. We start early Friday morning, go until Sunday afternoon. The Urban one, the new one that we're doing, the Urban Core Basics, is going to be two-day weekends. So people get there, they can camp out on Friday night. We start in on Saturday morning, and it goes all day Saturday, all day Sunday. This is run by Paul Range and Gloria Haswell, who I mentioned earlier, and they are they have a really, really cool series set up on this, in the sense that they're kind of taking everything that I had done, which I didn't really mention this before, and this isn't a sidetrack, but just to kind of complement what I said before, all the training that we try to do is scenario-based training, and the scenario basically is a disaster or a post shit hits the fan, apocalyptic type situation. And the reason I do that is because that increases how people learn. It increases the amount that they are able to digest. It increases the amount of time that they remember things when they've got a scenario around it. Now, in the basic core classes, it's very kinder, gentler kind of thing. But as we move up in level, it gets much more intense. And, there's a lot of stuff that happens that's more... That they're going to remember probably a lot longer.
It's very, very, very much from the military then, because I know whenever we would go out for an FTX, field training exercise, act as an opposing force in any type of training we did, they always gave us a scenario. This is a group of, whatever from this, unnamed country somewhere in the Middle East. And that way it made the training have a point. So that's
right.
You've drawn from that. That's very cool.
Yeah, very much so. Even my first time in the military when I was an interrogator, that was back in the day before SEER school was really a big deal, and it was, it was a big deal, but you could do SEER training on any base. So any base that had a division or larger could do SEER training. So you've had a lot of infantry division type places that were doing that, like Fort Carson did. And so, what would happen was these interrogators, like myself, we would plan this stuff out, and you'd have like a company of infantrymen that were out in the woods for 2 weeks and a lot of lack of sleep, hungry, already a little bit confused and discombobulated. And then in the middle of the night, they get attacked and they get captured, tied up, and all of us are speaking different languages. I mean, we're not even speaking the same language. Somebody might speak Russian, somebody speaking German. I mean, they don't even know. Most of them wouldn't, there was very, very few that were multilingual enough to know that. But that's the whole scenario. And then they go through a SEER training, so then they're in a situation where we spend about a week of training and then kind of debriefing and teaching them how to deal with the situation that they've just been through at best. And so anyway, definitely drawing on that kind of a scenario based opposing forces. I'm going to actually probably have, we've been using mostly ourselves, our other instructors, kind of my assistant instructors and then other graduates. We've used a little bit too of the Core Basic as role players. But I'd actually like to start, especially for some of the higher level classes, start hiring even like acting intern type people to just, play the role of whatever they're going to play and they're part of it. And so anyway, we do a lot of skills. The Core Basic is probably about, 10 to 20% of that role playing exercise, and the rest of it is all just learning skills. It's just like drinking out of a fire hose of all these skills. But back to the Core Basic, Urban, The urban one is definitely, I think, implements a little bit more scenario along with those skills. So, for instance, the first weekend, we kind of started in the, we started in the concept of a shelter. Then we move out to, like, the bug out, and then we move out to the community. So the shelter is, you know, for one reason or another, you ended up in a FEMA shelter. You know, whether you had to, whether you didn't, you know, because you needed the food and it was your only choice, or whether it was a bad decision or whether they made you, one reason or another, you're there. What do you expect? What's going to happen? And so we have like a mock FEMA exercise, you know, where they're going to do everything from getting an ID card to having to, having to take care of their own stuff. We have a little shower area set up. It's a very tight space for the number of people we'll have, I'm sure. It'll be uncomfortable. They're going to have to be around each other, you know, spending the night with other people who are snoring and farting and all the stuff that happens with, you know, a group of people that have to live together. We'll have, you know, situations to where if they don't watch their stuff, you know, it's going to get stolen. And so that's sort of the shelter side. Then move out to, okay, now you're bug out. You're in bug out mode. Maybe it's from the FEMA shelter, maybe it's, you know, from your own home, you know, what is a bug-out bag exactly, and how do you go about really packing it? If you already have one and you know that stuff, you bring it down and we critique it and we work with it, then you're going to go out and you're going to live off that bug-out bag, you know, for a night. And if you're home about, you're going to have to walk first. You know, you're not going to just, you know, walk 100 yards. We're going to make you walk a bit. So if you got a bunch of crap that you don't need and you're carrying 60 pounds on your back for 5 miles, you know, that's going to be very apparent. If you're freezing at night because you don't have any idea what you're taking for the, you know, what your bug out bag has in it to keep you warm, that's going to be a problem. They'll have skills up to that point, like they'll learn how to make a rocket stove and some of the different things that they can do. Of course, you know, they're not just sent out without, you know, training, but the whole idea is to really kind of coalesce all that training into, you know, sort of an exercise. Then the final one is, okay, now you've got a group of people, which is certainly much more, you know, strength in numbers, right? And so whether it's a couple of families together or whatever it is, you know, how do you do a vehicle caravan? How do you, you know, kind of circle them up in the, you know, the old Western circle up the wagons type of, you know, defensive perimeters? What is that all about? You know, how do you go about picking a place and location that you're going to have to stop because you are going to have to stop? You know, all of the different stuff that would come with having to actually move a group of people from one place to another, or just how do you organize your neighborhood? You know, how would you really work that? Because your house by itself is really almost an indefensible, you know, structure, unless you build it as a fortress, of course. So that all of that kind of winds into the core basic urban, and that's, like I say, 3 weekends spread over. There's one in January, one in March, or one in February and one in March. So 3 months in a row, three different weekends, part one, part two, part three, and they all build on each other, so you can't just jump into part two unless you've done part one. But they're good forever. So if you take a part one now, and you don't get to part two for 3 years, that's fine, you know. You can do it in 3 years.
Very cool. And one of the things that really kind of made me look at what you're doing and say this is different is that you have entire components built into this on, well, how do we put everything back together? How do we rebuild? Once this stuff's gone, not just how do we survive till tomorrow, but like you started saying in the beginning, how are our kids going to survive a generation after, you know, let's just be blunt, the shit has really hit the fan. It's as bad or worse than we can imagine. That's occurred. Now we got to put society back together. I've often been questioned, why am I so optimistic that we would even do it? You know, why? And my answer is because we're human beings. It's what we do. We build communities. If you take 100 people and throw them onto, you know, or 1,000 people and throw them onto an island, you come back in 200 years and you have Australia. That's what we do. There would be doctors, there would be teachers, but you've kind of taken it to, well, let's have a plan for if it does happen so we know where to start from. What made you bring that in?
That's sort of a two-part answer to that. And one part is, like you just said, you know, that's what we do. We're human beings, and that's what we do. So why not have a way to do that's functional, that's simple, easy to remember, and that functions on all levels? And that's where I originally came up with the whole idea of specialties. These specialties are also, on an individual level, you could call them archetypes, you know, basically of those five areas that I was talking about when I was talking about primitive engineer and combat medic and so forth. On a team level, they're specialties. On a community level, they are basically subdividing an infrastructure out into areas that have to exist in order for a community to exist. And the mentality behind all of them is is a, you know, a resource friendly and a renewable type of attitude. And so the green homesteading fits right into that aspect of it, of course. But that's just really half of it. That's the half that says, you know, if we have to rebuild, how would we do it? Well, I mean, look at us. You know, we're a mess. I mean,
yeah.
The way that, you know, so it's like, why not do it right? And it's not that, you know, I'm not advocating that we go back and live in teepees or caves or anything like that. We have the technology. We have the knowledge, the ability, all of the things we need to literally live completely renewably on this planet. I mean, we have everything we need. So why aren't we doing it, you know? So that's the second part is as you started getting into green homesteading, I'm trying to create a blueprint to take, you know, Joe suburbanite into this green homesteading idea. It's like, okay, no, you don't have to go out and spend, you know, $200,000 and build yourself a green home. Nobody has those kinds of means. But let's take it one thing at a time, you know. First of all, where does your water come from? Do you even know that? You know, do you have any, if you live in the San Antonio area here, you know, you do hear it a bit, so people at least understand that water comes from an aquifer. But out of the people, everybody here, if you asked everybody what is an aquifer, you might get 10% of people actually giving you a correct answer. And how does that work? And where does the water come from? When we flush the toilet, where does it go to? How does that all work? And then move to the next level, you know, especially in an area, again, like South Texas, where water is a very, you know, precious commodity. What are our other options? Well, hey, how about rainwater collection? Well, now that's starting to pull, you know, become mainstream now anyway, but how do you do it? Well, it's certainly very easy to teach that. It's very easy to do, and it's very cheap to do compared to, you know, a lot of other things. So, I mean, so what people do usually when they hear the word, you know, going green, it's like the dollar signs start spinning in their eyes, like, oh, my God, you know, I can't afford this. And so I'm trying to kind of create also a blueprint that's both interesting because people come out and they can build. You know, I mean, we go through everything from literally how do you pick the right piece of land? What are the legal implications? Gloria has a real estate license. You know, what's all that? And then how do you pick the place to build in that piece of land? You know, where do you build? Why? How do you lay out a foundation? How do you lay out, you know, where you're going, what it's going to be? How do you, all the things that go into basically building. And then how do you pick what kind of green home you're going to build? And we will build. We'll have a structure that's got, you know, it might have an earthship wall, it might have a rammed earth wall, it might have a hay bale wall, and a build, you know, all the different things we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many, you know, so I'm not saying we're going to have every single thing, but we're going to have a wide variety of some of the most common types of green building structures so that people can actually, you know, get sweaty and have to do the work a little bit and see, oh, this is what it really involves to do this. And then they take away from that, hopefully, to their own home and you know, in suburbia or in the city or wherever they're living, you know, oh, wow, you know, I realize now that I've seen how this is done, that it's really, really easy for me to go ahead and install rainwater collection, or it's really easy for me to just install solar and 12-volt just for something simple, you know, something real simple, just a pump, you know, and I understand what, you know, I know how to make an aquaponics tank, you know, for a total of about $50, you
mm-hmm.
know, and it can be solar-powered for another $20 because I've done all of that. And so that's what we're trying, again, going back to that analogy I had about, you know, touching everything in your home for the day and being able to maybe describe about, you know, 5% of it, this, you know, trying to up that percent a little bit too.
Absolutely. I'll tell you a couple things that you made me think of there when you're talking is, one, the expense of doing a lot of these things. Some of them you can do on your own very primitively, and we can see that because you'll say, well, it's expensive to do this, they're expensive to do that, but you go to the parts of the world where the poorest people in the world live, and they do it because they don't have a choice. So if they can do it, us with all our money and resources, we can do it. But the other side of it is, it amazes me that we have people right now, in spite of everything that's happened, throwing money, you know, 10% or 15% or 5%, whatever it is, into that 401k every month. Throw it in there.
Yep.
And they're going to retire $500,000, $750,000 that'll probably buy, when they retire, what maybe $100,000 buys today because of inflation. And then they're going to draw from that to pay an electric bill. They're going to draw from that to pay a water bill. Where these things that seem expensive today, if we build that infrastructure for ourselves today, at that point, the value of that infrastructure is so much higher. And instead of having to draw from those things to provide your needs, you can do what you're supposed to do in your, you know, your retirement years, if you want to call them that, which for me is can be much younger if we do these things, and buy what we want and have some type of quality of life instead of having enough to scrape by with what's left of Social Security, if that joke's even still around, and whatever we've managed to save for ourselves. And I think, I mean, a big lesson here is we look at the cost of repairing like bridges and roads and all this infrastructure in the United States today. And you go, well, we built it in the 30s. Why can't we just fix it today? Well, because the cost of infrastructure goes up with inflation, like, faster than anything else. So to do the same thing we did in 1950, we can't afford to do it today. And we're in a position as humans where if we'll build this infrastructure for ourselves today, I just feel like 20 years from now, you know, when you're leaving it to your kids or your grandkids or whatever, is you're going to look, damn, that was a cheap investment, really, when it comes down to it. So I love what you're doing there. How can folks attend your classes? How do they sign up? Where can they learn more? Things like that.
The best way, really, to get to anything is just to go to my website, which is thehumanpath.com. And all one word, no underscores or underlines or anything, just thehumanpath.com. And if you go there, you'll see there's a nav bar, of course, across the top, like any website. And I think there's one that's called schedule or something like that. And basically, it's a drop down, and you'll see a link to calendar. And if you go to the calendar, you'll see that each month, you know, shows a number of classes in there, and any given month has the class in there as a link, and all you got to do is click on that link. So, for instance, if there's a class coming up, the Core Basic, that'll be a link in whatever in the little box that says, this, you know, January 22nd. Then you click on that, that'll take you to a place that you can sign up for the class. And I use just for my own organization and stuff, I use a site called meetup.com. which allows me to, you know, collect money. It allows me to send out emails. It allows me to do a lot of different stuff and to have, you know, a forum and people that are like-minded are able to talk and stuff. So you got to sign up to meetup.com, which doesn't cost anything. There's no spam or anything like that. You just got to register, give your email so that, you know, you have a way of being contacted, and then you can sign up for the class itself.
Yeah, meetup's great. We have a lot of our folks that do, like, you know, just a community get-togethers and all around the TSP philosophy that run it. So I think the audience is probably real familiar with it. Another thing I want to make sure I hit on with before we wrap up here, because this really intrigued me, one of your trainers is actually a certified permaculturist. And that's a huge topic around here is permaculture. And, you know, what was the big drive to bring that philosophy in, and how has that made what you're doing maybe different than the, you know, 20 other options a person has to get some training on some stuff like this?
Sure, and that's actually two of them are. It's Gloria and Paul both are.
Oh, they're both are. That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's sort of a mixed bag simply because it's becoming so popular now that it's, you know, you can pretty much, I don't know, anywhere, but certainly around San Antonio and Austin, you're going to be able to find permaculture classes. We're trying to, as usual, you know, of course, because I want to try to always be able to offer people more, give them more experience than anybody else can. And not because I'm trying to be competitive, although, you know, we all are, of course, that's part of life and certainly in business, but just because I want to, you know, I want to be able to say a year from now that every class I'm doing is better than it was a year ago. You know, I always want to be improving because it gives back to the people, it gives back to the students, the people that are paying me to teach them. And I love that interaction. I love teaching. So with permaculture, one thing we're going to do is we are actually going to build. I have a 50-acre quarry that is where I use for most of my classes. And out of that 50 acres, maybe 15 of it or so is actual quarry. And there's a pond on it. And there's some dugout. Of course, you know, areas that are dug out. Maybe a 10-acre spread that's completely dug out, maybe, you know, 30 feet below the surface of the road that goes around the edge of it. And so what we're going to do is we're going to build terraces that work their way up to some of the walls, because some of those walls need support anyway. And we'll do permaculture terraces, basically, and we'll do all kinds of different stuff. We'll pump, you know, from the pond going up, we'll pump water up with windmill and do drip irrigation back down to a small wetlands area back into the pond. We'll do, classes that are basically based around not just, you know, showing a PowerPoint slide, although there's that too. Of course, we have a classroom. We do that too. There has to be lecture, but we actually do a lot more of the hands-on stuff where we're getting out there, getting people's hands dirty, being able to say, okay, this is what that actually looks like when you're done. The same idea with aquaponics, which is just wonderful. You know, you can build, you know, great aquaponics stuff. Paul is an expert at that, and he's done some great aquaponics tanks. We'll do a couple out there. We'll do classes out there, and it's, you know, it's sort of a mixture of both the permaculture and our renewable, you know, type gardening, along with of course, if you put fish in there, of having your own meat source as well, protein source as well.
Yeah, I think that's huge because, I mean, to me, the most effective method of home meat production is going to be aquaponics. It's the great, you get the greatest return because a fish can grow, convert biomass into meat far easier than a chicken or a rabbit because they're, you know, basically existing in what comes out to be a net zero gravity environment. So it takes less energy to make a fish than to make, you know, the big fat gray squirrel that's sitting on my feeder looking at me through the window right now. He has to eat a lot more black willow sunflower and acorn than a tilapia. I can feed a tilapia duckweed. I can grow the duckweed in my aquaponics system. And that's almost insane that you can have the closest thing in the world I've seen to a true closed loop system is aquaponics.
Exactly. Yeah, it's fascinating, actually.
So, again, folks can find you at thehumanpath.com. And I think, folks, if you are – I'll tell you what. First of all, I've worked with Sam directly. I've experienced his training directly. The guy's solid and knows his craft just beautifully. He's also put together something that I don't really know of any one source anywhere that you can get all of this under one roof. So that was a big part of why when he asked to come on the show, I was like, absolutely, let's get you on. So I think if you're in Texas or Oklahoma or general area – You're kind of nuts if you don't try to take advantage of this opportunity because some of his classes just flat out fill up and they can only take so many students. They only have so many instructors. But I'll tell you that this is absolutely worth getting on an airplane for and traveling from another part of the country to be involved and to get some training from Sam at thehumanpath.com, right?
Thehumanpath.com. And on that note, too, starting in fall, about a year from now, we'll be doing I'm going to try to combine I'm going to combine some of the weekend classes, certainly the Urban Core Basic, the Primitive Core Basic into a full 6-day course so that people who live way out of town and want to fly in can come in for 1 week.
And do the whole thing.
It'll be a lot more intense that way, too. So I think it'll be a really good thing to do that and to step into that.
That would be awesome. That'd be something I'd be into because it's so hard for me to pull away. And I think there's a lot of people. It's not the cost. It's right. The time, right? And if I've got to travel, 2 days becomes four, and it'd be easier for me to do 7 or 8 days gone than 4 days gone four times. So that's really, I'm glad to see that you're going to try to do that. But definitely check it. And you've got a YouTube channel as well. So people, I think, really should check out your YouTube channel. Some of your videos are pretty cool. Anything that we've left out you want to make sure folks know about? You got anything else going on I missed?
Yeah, I think one thing I did want to mention really quickly is that I'm really big into fitness, functional fitness, of course. I mean, everything that I'm trying to do, if you haven't figured that out already, I'm pretty much kind of a pragmatist about it. I mean, it's got to work. That goes from herbology and plants to anything. It's got to work, and it's got to pass that litmus test of, you know, did it work? And so the same thing with fitness. You know, I'm really trying to take fitness out of the realm of the 24-hour, you know, closed indoor gyms. And put it into what really works. And so I've gone a bunch of different ways on this. I started a thing called survival racing. And the idea was to really present a challenge for anybody, anywhere around the world who said they had the skills to be able to come out and prove it, you know, come out to a survival race. And it wouldn't just be a matter of running from, you know, it wouldn't be like an adventure race where it's just a matter of finding some points and running or biking or swimming to get there. It would be once you get there, there's a skill station, you know. You've got to start a hand drill or a bow drill fire or whatever, identify some tracks or whatever it is, and based on how you do at that station would determine what your next leg of the journey would be, you know, in terms of distance and so forth. So, you know, that was my original idea. And now it's kind of all, you know, I really tried to, I think I got away from the skills and went more into the fitness side, and I'm trying to bring it all back down. So in April, we'll be starting some combat fitness on every Tuesday and what I call scout fitness on every Thursday. And so we've got myself, which my background is kind of more stand-up. I was actually an amateur MMA fighter for a little while, but I've studied, you know, God, I don't know how many martial arts since I was 13, a lot of Chinese stuff, Wing Chun and such. That all the way through kind of what my love is, which is grappling and ground fighting. And then we've got a really great Kali teacher who has about 30 years of experience as a Kali instructor. So, you know, we've got kind of Filipino stick a knife thing going on for, for that. And then just basic fitness, you know, all kinds of different fitness, whether it's ground fitness or standing fitness and that. And then the Scout fitness itself, which is really more about moving from point A to point B. So a lot of endurance, a lot of mountain biking type stuff, running. Eventually we probably get into some horseback riding. I've got obstacle courses that are natural obstacle courses set up with, you know, actual tree trunks, not just, you know, telephone poles and such. And, you know, running through that when you're at a higher level with somebody, you know, running behind you shooting a paintball gun at you, you know, those types of things are going on. So we've got all that kind of stuff as well. So it's a lot of fun.
That's very cool. And what about the person right now that you just turned off that just went, wow, man, that's trying to keep up with these special forces guys and stuff like that. Your training, from what I saw of it, can be really, really intense. But also, you know, I saw a lady, you know, run a few paces, pick up a rock and throw it, and run a few places and pick up a rock and throw it on one of your videos. So the word you use is functional fitness, and there's a lot that comes in with that that's kind of brought to the level of the individual. And the more they do, the more they can do, right?
Exactly. And I try to really stress that because, yeah, you're right. You totally hit the nail on the head. I get a lot of people that are saying, oh, God, I'd love to come out to that, but I just don't think I can. And it's not what it's about at all. And if you've been to my classes, you know that I'm all about making sure that every single, you know, first of all, we don't have big classes. The biggest class I can possibly teach by myself, you know, with some helpers is 25, and even that's really too big. But, you know, usually they range between 15 and 20 people. So it's, you get a lot of individualized tension, and everybody walks away. I don't care if you've never, you know, if you don't even know how to start a fire with a match, you're going to walk away and you will have set a Bodrill fire. I guarantee you within about 3 hours, I will teach you how to do it and you'll get there. And so the same thing goes with fitness. I don't care if you've never, you know, you're a couch potato and you've never walked over a block in your life. All I care about is that you come there with the right attitude and the motivation that you want to work your body, you know, to the extent that you're able to do it. And the rest I'll take care of. You know, it's my job.
You know, there's something I want to ask you about, get your thoughts on, that I've talked to quite a few other trainers I've had on the show that also have military backgrounds, and I've noticed in commonality. I know Ron Hood does this, Dave Canterbury does this, you're doing this. When I look at military people and they come into the civilian world, and I don't care if they're teaching someone how to fix a car or survive in the woods or handle financial transactions, the thing that I think makes military-style training the best in the world is it's broken down into blocks and components in a different way than general academic settings. It's designed to be, we take this block and we teach it to you to a point where you almost can't forget it. And then when I give you another block, you now can put the two together and do more than the sum of the parts of either one. Has there been a lot of that military background beyond, you know, they taught you how to do some of this stuff in the military, but the format, has that come a lot from your military background?
Yeah, I'd have to admit it probably does, and more so even in the content. I mean, honestly, you know, in all honesty, when I went into Special Forces, you know, the survival training did nothing for me, not even close. I mean, I was...
You're not the only one we've had on here that said that has that kind of background.
Okay. Good, and I'm probably preaching to the choir, and, you know, because I don't mean to say that it's bad at all. It's great training, but it's just, you know, it's way beyond it. And the same with hand-to-hand and combat. I mean, I've been doing martial arts for, I don't know, probably 15 years before I went in, you know, the SF, and it was so basic and nothing. So my point is not so much the content, but definitely, absolutely the structure. I totally agree with you. I mean, I went to language school. Now, granted, I was really into language, and I would say that's one of my talents is foreign languages. You know, I took Latin and Russian and Spanish in high school, and I loved it. And I went into the military as an interrogator in order to be able to get to language school. So I went to a language school, and in 8 months, you know, they taught me from not speaking a word of German, you know, to in 8 months, I would say conversationally fluent. And that gave me enough that once I went over there, and of course, I lucked out at my age, especially. I was just a kid. And I ended up living, you know, on the border. Back then it was an east-west German border, in a civilian clothes, civilian car, and lived with my civilian girlfriend. And I spoke maybe, you know, I spoke 90% German for 3 years. And within a year and a half of being over there, you know, if you could talk to me and you didn't know me and you knew that I was, and you found out during our conversation I was American from me speaking, it was a bad day for me. I mean, I would go home and I'd be like, oh my God.
I messed up, right?
Yeah. I got to practice. Yeah, I messed up. So, I mean, I was very much fluent within about a year and a half. And that, I owe that all to the military, the way they broke that down. And it's the same, certainly, with Special Forces.
Yeah.
Special Forces Medic School is just, I mean, it's a year of drinking out of a fire hose, but it's the best training I think I've ever had in my life.
Yeah, I mean, some of the survival training, the reason I think that you have to modify the content for the civilian isn't that it's not effective, it's that it has a different purpose. If you're if you're a military person and you're behind enemy lines, your goal, you know, first goal is to not be seen, right? You don't want to get caught.
Right.
And your second goal is to get the heck back to where you came from. Your third goal is to do those two things as quickly and expediently as possible, where a civilian in a survival situation may be wanting to make as much noise and be as visible as they possibly can to get found. And that person is more concerned with living while they're there than just getting the hell out of Dodge. So it's two different worlds, and you have to bring the two together. It looks like you've done a beautiful job of that. So again, folks, Sam's website, thehumanpath.com. Can't recommend you check it out highly enough. And Sam, thanks for being here today. One more time, we tried to do this before, and we ended up another 10 minutes in, but we can go as long as we want. Is there anything else we've left out?
Better not. Every time I open up my mouth, it'll be another 10 minutes. I tell you, I can talk all day. But no, that's great. Thanks so much for having me, Jack. I love your website and your podcast, especially a lot too. I think you're doing a great thing, and it's really a privilege, and I'm flattered to have been able to be on your show.
Well, hey, don't worry about talking too much here, because I guarantee you we're going to want to have you back again. I think we can take any one of these subjects and have you on just as a subject matter expert on it and go into it deeper. So we'll probably want to do that in the future if you'll be game for it.
Oh, that'd be great. Anytime, any subject, that would be awesome.
Great, Sam. Well, again, folks, with that, I will go ahead and wrap up. Remember, check out thehumanpath.com. And this has been Jack Spirico today with Sam, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't.
There's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, and we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Up.